or here. So go home and just keep quiet. Don't talk to anybody until we see what develops. That's the best advice I can give you right now." Gargan was trying to be kind. "I was thinking of them, basically. Getting away from this whole thing." Deputized to take care of the girls, Tretter spent a very uncomfortable hour or so before he was told to remove them from the Katama Shores Motel. Gargan gave the order. He said, "Put them in the car and take them to the ferry. Get them out of here." Gargan returned to the police station. Markham showed him the senator's statement. Gargan sort of perused it. I didn't read it at that time. He was satisfied the senator had admitted being the driver of the accident car. He didn't have to know anything else. Gargan checked out of the Shiretown Inn. He returned to Chappaquiddick to pack up the debris left from the party and pick up LaRosa and Crimmins. He called Steve Gentle to say the cottage was now vacant. Gargan turned up at Edgartown Dock to pay Captain Manuel de Freitas $50 cash for the charter of the boat on Saturday, then rushed off without explaining why the young women would not be observing the races. The fleet of regatta boats was becalmed in the harbor. Gargan sought out John Linehan of the Hyannisport Yacht Club to ask if the committee boat could tow the Victoria back. "Will you do us that favor after the races today? We're all screwed up." The Wiano class event was canceled at 3 o'clock. "That was a bad summer," Gargan recalled. "The winds were not good all that summer." Gargan spoke briefly with Jack Driscoll at the Shiretown Inn. Driscoll was concerned about rumors he'd heard about an accident involving Ted Kennedy. The senator had not, as Gargan hoped, consulted Driscoll about reporting the accident when he returned to the Shiretown Inn. Gargan couldn't tell Driscoll much, except to confirm an accident had occurred. The senator was driving, but had not been injured. When Driscoll asked why the accident had not been reported for 10 hours, Gargan said, cryptically, "He didn't take my advice." Marilyn Richards thought the whispers between Driscoll and her husband had started around 1 o'clock. "We weren't asked to the party at Chappaquiddick, but Jack was, and he told us about it. When Ross told me around 3 o'clock what had happened, I was absolutely floored. I wondered what on earth Ted Kennedy had been up to, wanting to chat at that hour of the morning. And he hadn't said one word about the accident. I thought it was all very strange." Gargan telephoned his wife in South Bend, Indiana. He charged the call to the senator's credit card used for advance and scheduling expenses. Others in Kennedy's office carried the card, including Dunn Gifford. Betty Gargan had heard about the accident on the radio. She was saddened and distressed by the news. The party at Chappaquiddick was typical of the kind of campaign get-together she had happily participated in the year before, Gargan observed. It wasn't a scandalous party, but in the light of unfolding events, it was starting to look like one. But given the record of previous Kennedy regatta parties, Gargan had grounds for concern his sentimental reunion for the boiler room could be misinterpreted. Parties held in 1966 and 1967 had been riotous affairs. The 1967 party had left a rental cottage at Katama Beach in shambles. Ted Kennedy's date had reportedly begun an affair with him during the weekend that had continued for over 2 years. Gargan hadn't had much to do with that weekend's festivities, attorney Jack Driscoll having made the rental arrangements. Ray LaRosa's wife was upset when she was told about the accident. LaRosa hadn't known a party was planned when he accepted an invitation to come to Edgartown for the regatta. LaRosa helped load the party's leavings into his Mercury. Then Gargan returned the Valiant to a Hertz agency in Edgartown. LaRosa drove to Vineyard Haven to get a ferry to Woods Hole. Gargan called the senator's house in Hyannisport from the dock. "We're on our way," he said. "We're leaving the island right now." Gargan had accomplished his cleanup detail with his customary dispatch and efficiency. He had left no evidence behind that a party had taken place at the cottage on Chappaquiddick, and all the guests who had attended had escaped the island before Edgartown police even knew they were there. On the ferry to Woods Hole, Jack Crimmins was doubly furious at Gargan for having rented a cottage on Chappaquiddick, given the incident that had occurred there. Gargan conceded Crimmins had a point. The whole problem about reporting the accident was that damn little island, Goggins said later. If the accident had taken place in Edgartown, it would never have shaped up as it did. There would have been communication. We would have all been together. That little spit of water the ferry goes back and forth on is what screwed up the whole situation. The channel was like an obstacle. If it had been a bridge instead of a landing, we could have driven across and been in the center of Edgartown in a matter of 30 seconds, gotten out of the car and walked over to the police station. Only there wasn't any walking over, unless the senator was Jesus Christ and could walk on water. Goggin regretted having rented a cottage on Chappaquiddick. Had he gotten to Edgartown earlier and taken a place on South Beach the way he wanted, the whole thing would never have happened. Goggin unloaded the Mercury at his house in Hyannisport. Then he walked over to the command post on the compound. The councils already in progress there were no more than hand-wringing sessions of commiseration. There were people involved who did not understand the laws of Massachusetts regarding insurance coverage and other things. People who thought that because of this accident, there was going to be millions and millions of dollars of lawsuits, Goggin said. Although others were excited about that, I was not. There wasn't much likelihood of anything in the way of heavy damages coming out of the accident, because it would be impossible to prove pain and suffering on account of the way the accident happened. Goggin wanted no part in the discussion of the accident, or why it hadn't been reported for 10 hours. He'd come to rescue Paul Markham from the postmortems and take him back to his house as an overnight guest. Friends since they had played football together at Georgetown Prep, and former associates in the U.S. Attorney's Office, Goggin and Markham talked about the accident and what Ted had said about it in his statement. Markham had written out a description of the accident from the senator's dictation. He had corrected errors in grammar, but played no part in the deception the senator had practiced in failing to mention the party at Chappaquiddick, and his claim to have been in shock after the accident. Goggin couldn't make that judgment in the drive to the ferry, he said. Maybe I should have realized the senator was in more serious trouble than I thought. So I missed the boat and so did Paul. Goggin had no idea what happened after the senator took 3 steps and started swimming. Up to that point, Goggin said, I'm still dealing with a guy I've known for 30 years who's always done what he said he was going to do. The senator had told Markham nothing at the police station regarding his rate of speed or the quantity of alcohol he'd consumed at the party. Goggin couldn't tell how much the senator had to drink, he said. He did not appear to be under the influence, but I don't know whether he was or not. The wrong turn was particularly puzzling. When he saw the senator leave the cottage, the assumption was he was going to the ferry. Where he went, what he did, if he stopped somewhere or did something else, I don't know, Goggin said. He could have changed his mind about getting the ferry. All kinds of things could have happened after he went out the door of the cottage. It's entirely possible he went down that road deliberately to take a swim. But Goggin didn't believe the senator was taking Mary Jo to the beach to make love to her. He said, they both had comfortable hotel rooms to go to, so it didn't make sense for him to go down there for that purpose. The senator had not mentioned the rescue attempted by Goggin and Markham at the bridge in his police report. Kennedy told Markham, look, I don't want you people put in the middle of this thing. I'm not going to involve you. As far as you know, you didn't know anything about the accident. With Markham at the police station, and Goggin putting in 2 appearances there, Arena would have had 2 witnesses available to corroborate the senator's accident report. By not involving them, the senator was guaranteeing Markham and Goggin wouldn't be questioned. Was Kennedy protecting himself from revealing that 2 lawyers had known about the accident hours before he'd gone to the police, and that those lawyers had repeatedly urged him to report the accident, advice Kennedy refused to follow? Well, the senator had not said so specifically. The impression Arena was bound to get was that Markham was acting as his attorney at the police station, a presence that might have inhibited his interrogation. As it was, Arena was a police officer of unusual goodwill, accommodating to the point of indulgence in his treatment of the senator, Markham said. The police chief appeared to have accepted the senator's accident report at face value. When Markham last spoke to him, Arena had given no indication he intended to press charges against the senator, and was handling the accident as a routine motor vehicles case. Chapter 15. Shortly after Inspector Herbert Burr came on duty in the radio room at registry headquarters on Sunday morning, he received a call to see if he could find a license for Edward M. Kennedy. When Burr found no record in the files, he went to the tab room. Here, licenses were key-punched on IBM cards, attached to perforated renewal forms. Upon separation, the license was mailed to operators. The renewal card placed on circulating metal trays before being put in the registry's files. The procedure took from 2 to 6 weeks. When I looked in the trays, there were all yellow renewal cards there, Burr said later. Among them was a license in the name of Edward M. Kennedy, valid until February 22, 1971. Burr had, on other occasions, found licenses that had been in the tab room for some time and hadn't been put in the files, but not for 5 months. Burr couldn't explain the anomaly in the report on the license check he made to Carl Catalano, chief of special investigations. Having received confirmation of a valid license, Inspector George Red Kennedy went to Edgartown Police Station, accompanied by Joseph Grealish. Grealish delivered the license number and expiration date to Arena. Arena completed his citation. He was sending the offender's copy by registered mail to Ted Kennedy at Hyannisport. In doing so, Arena wasn't following standard police procedure. Such tickets were ordinarily delivered in person. That he was seeking to prosecute the senator for leaving the scene of the accident after causing personal injury marked the end of his investigation, Arena told a dozen reporters at the police station. From his examination of the accident scene, Arena was firmly convinced there was no criminal negligence involved. But in the matter of the time period after the accident, there is in my eyes a violation concerning going from the scene, leaving the scene. That the delay lasted 10 hours was not important, Arena said. If he sat in his house for 5 minutes without reporting the accident, he was in violation of the law. Reporters wanted to know if Arena had looked into the possibility the accident was related to drinking at a party prior to Ted Kennedy driving off Dyke Bridge. Having been deceived about the party, Arena had not asked that question of the senator, he said. There was no other physical evidence at the scene that there might have been drinking. I'm not pursuing that line at all. I'm still standing on the fact that there was no negligence involved. I really believe the accident is strictly accidental. Arena had no plans to question those who had attended the party. The only witnesses to Kennedy's conduct on the night of the accident had been Kennedy's friends. In Arena's judgment, none could be expected to contradict his account or say anything to worsen his situation, so he saw no point in questioning them. I'm firmly convinced the senator told me the correct story. He impresses me as a senator and as a man who would tell the truth, Arena said. I think the senator was more than cooperative with me, because he released a statement more openly than most citizens might. Most citizens would want to talk with their attorney first. Arena conceded he'd given Kennedy a chance to speak in private with former U.S. Attorney Paul Markham, who accompanied him to the police station. Arena was surprised neither Ted Kennedy nor his representatives had called him to provide more details about the accident. I wouldn't say I was left out in the cold, he said. But I did expect some additional information. So did reporters. Arena was not likely to be the one to provide it. Reporters liked Arena because he was pleasant and accessible. But the consensus was that Arena seemed incapable of hanging a rap on Ted Kennedy more serious than a misdemeanor traffic violation. Nor was he galvanized into action by the mysterious aspects gathering around the accident to do much investigating, appearing more concerned with explaining away any possible wrongdoing on the senator's part. Arena thought the case so wrapped up, he'd even disposed of the original police report. It wasn't in Kennedy's handwriting, so I copied it and threw it away. Weeks later, Carmen Salvador admitted she'd fished the document from a wastebasket to keep as a souvenir. Arena demanded the statement returned. I felt it would be good for my files, because I figured I'm the one guy that's going to get questioned about this thing for the rest of my life. But even after it had been returned, the document proved elusive. The truth is, one page of the damn thing did disappear again, Arena said. I don't know where the hell it went. Arena had to be reminded by reporter Ed Crosetti of the Boston Record-American. Chief, you better talk to Huck Look. Arena had neglected to question the deputy sheriff in the confusion of events on Saturday. Look's comments at Dyke Bridge hadn't seemed critical. Whether the accident occurred at 11:15 p.m., as Kennedy said in his report, or after Look saw the car, didn't make much difference insofar as a leaving-the-scene charge was concerned. Arena said, "The question of time only became an issue after the press picked up inconsistencies in Kennedy's report." A husky man with the high color of the outdoors and a plain-spoken country boy manner, Look was reluctant to retell his story officially for the record, in view of the senator's published account of the accident. Look regretted having blurted out information before he realized its significance. Look had seen a dark car between 12:40 a.m. and 12:45 a.m., Saturday morning, approaching the bend on Chappaquiddick Road at the center of the intersection of Dyke Road. Arena noted, "He is positive there was a man driving and that there was someone next to him. He thinks there may have been someone else in the back seat, but he's not sure." The car appeared unsure or lost. Look stopped and started to walk toward the car, but the driver had sped off down Dyke Road. Look's story sounded okay to Arena. "The thing that bothered me about it was Huck was so adamant about his time. I did believe he saw this particular thing, but I was between a stone and a hard place because I couldn't disprove Kennedy's time." Look was more closely interrogated by George Killen and Bernie Flynn when the two detectives arrived in Edgartown around noon. Arena hadn't asked for their help. The chief had left the station, telling reporters, "It's my day off. I'm going home to my family." "This was more a spectator thing," Flynn explained. "George didn't want us involved, but he wanted to know what was going on. Because if Denise stepped in, our office would get the case." Flynn and Killen made a formidable pair, at opposite ends of the police spectrum. Taciturn and rigidly principled, Killen was in austere contrast to the good-looking blonde with a fiery temper, as likely to crash through a door as to knock. A tough street cop, Flynn was like a dog in heat when he sank his teeth into an investigation. Killen had taken an instant dislike to the younger man when Flynn joined his office in January 1967, regarding him as an angle player and a wise guy. Flynn had few scruples when it came to beating criminals at their own game. Cape Cod was tame stuff after violent, gritty New Bedford, upon whose mean streets Flynn had worked his way up from patrolman to captain of the uniformed branch. Flynn had cut a considerable law enforcement swath through the economically depressed former Mill City, riddled with municipal corruption. Before moving over to the state police and leaving town, Flynn sent a former mayor to jail for taking payoffs and made a host of enemies, not the least of whom was a prominent physician with whose wife Flynn had carried on a scandalous love affair. The doctor's political connections reached into the office of Governor John Volpe. Dismissal from the state police or banishment to some remote corner of Massachusetts was in the offing for Flynn, Killen confided to Frank Keating. "George told me the colonel of the state police was going to call Bernie in," Keating said, "and they were going to move him out because of this affair." Unlike Killen, Keating admired Flynn's quick intelligence and dashing style as a police officer, and so it was Keating who warned him of trouble brewing. Flynn used political connections of his own to head off a hearing and retain his plum assignment on Cape Cod. Outstanding detective work on several difficult cases over those 2 years had earned Frank Killen's admiration, then, ultimately, his trust. Killen knew Huck Look as a reliable and responsible court officer from cases he'd prosecuted in Edgartown. Look agreed to accompany the police officers to Chappaquiddick to reenact his encounter with the Kennedy car. Look had worked as a special police officer at the Edgartown Yacht Club Regatta Dance from 8 o'clock to 12:30 on Friday night, Brought to Chappaquiddick in the yacht club's launch, Look got into his car parked at the landing and headed home. He had seen the headlights of a car coming toward him near the curve at the intersection. Knowing the road, I slowed down, because there's a sharp corner that people usually will cut too close, Look said. I wanted to make sure I didn't get sideswiped. Look came almost to a complete stop. A black sedan passed in front of his headlights. There was a man driving, a woman in the front seat, and either another person or some clothing, a sweater or a pocketbook in the back seat. What appeared to be a shadow of some kind. The car went off the pavement into the private, dirt cemetery road. By this time, Look had proceeded around the corner a little bit, he said. I observed in my rearview mirror that the car was parked, and it looked like they were going to back up. I thought they wanted information, that they were lost or something. Look got out of his car and walked toward the other vehicle. He was 25 to 30 feet away when the car started backing up toward him, taillights showing all over the deputy sheriff uniform he was wearing. Look believed the driver must have seen him, as the lights glanced off the badge and whistle on his shirt. He started to call out an offer of help, but the car took off down Dyke Road in a cloud of dust. He observed a Massachusetts registration letter, L, he said, and I did sort of a photostatic thing in my mind that it had sevens in it, at the beginning and the end. Look returned to his car. A short distance from the intersection, he saw two women and a man doing a snake dance down the middle of the road, like a conga line. He stopped to ask if they needed a lift. The tall girl of the trio said, "Shove off, buddy, we're not pickups." The man in the group apologized. "Thank you, no," he said. "We're just going over there to our house." Look mentioned the lost car to his wife when he got home at 1 o'clock. I figured it was a man and his wife arguing about what direction to go. "That's the first thing that came into my mind," he said. "So many visitors come to Edgartown in the summer, you kind of get used to people getting lost." Look wondered where the car was headed at that time of night. There weren't many places to go on Chappaquiddick once the ferry stopped running. Given without hesitation, guile, or calculation, Look's story was in clear contradiction of Senator Kennedy's report about the time the accident had occurred, and the wrong turn he said he'd made at the intersection. If it was Kennedy's car, and every indication was that it was, to make a wrong turn, a driver would have to ignore, one, a directional arrow of luminized glass pointing to the left, two, the banking of the pavement to accommodate the sharp curve, three, the white line down the center of the road. To accomplish such a maneuver, a driver would also need to slow to a stop to make an abrupt 90-degree turn onto the unmistakable jarring ruts of Dyke Road, a buckboard ride Flynn and Killen endured on their way to take a look at Dyke Bridge, no more than a frail platform standing over Poca Pond. Dyke House was so close to the bridge, there's no way you could go down that road and not see that house, Flynn observed. It stuck out like a sore thumb. Diagonally across the road from Dyke House, yet another residence was clearly visible from the road. Flynn counted two more houses Senator Kennedy had passed when he'd returned to the cottage, after plunging into the pond. It took Flynn and Killen 23 minutes to walk the 1.2 miles from the bridge to the cottage, a nondescript house of weathered cedar shingles, only 150 yards from the Chappaquiddick Volunteer Fire Station. A red bulb burned over the unlocked door of the cement block fire station. A switch inside tripped a roof-mounted siren. Had the alarm been sounded, I would have been there in 3 minutes, and my volunteers and half the people on the island would have shown up within 15 minutes, Fire Captain Foster Silva said. Silva challenged Flynn and Killen when they came up the flagstone path from a split-rail fence to the property he was guarding from curious reporters and tourists. Watchmen for various summer residents and the trustees of reservations that maintained a wildlife refuge on the eastern shore of Chappaquiddick, Silva had let himself in with a caretaker's key provided by the cottage owner, Sidney Lawrence of Scarsdale, New York. Learning of the accident, Lawrence immediately went to Edgartown and inspected the place on Saturday night. He found it swept clean of any evidence a party had been held there. Lawrence told Silva, "They were real cute about that. I only found 8 empty Coke bottles. Even the trash barrels had been emptied. Silva lived less than 100 yards from the cottage. He had no trouble remembering the party held there on Friday night. He had watched television until 10 p.m. when his dogs started barking. I went outside with my wife to quiet the dogs and saw 2-3 cars at the Lawrence house, he said. There was a lot of singing and laughing coming from the house. I would say it was just a normal cocktail party. They were damned loud, though. Silva went to bed around midnight, but couldn't sleep with all the noise the dogs were making because of the party next door. Silva thought the revelers were inconsiderate in not lowering their voices after 11 p.m. By 1 o'clock, I was pretty well damn fed up with the whole thing. It was a damn farce at that hour of the morning. If they had kept it up any longer, I would have called the police. Silva's son-in-law also described the party as one of those loud, noisy brawls put on by summer people. It was yelling, music, and general sounds of hell-raising. The talk and laughter continued until 1:30 a.m., then quieted down. Silva's wife, Dodie, said, "You could still hear people talking, but the noise level was not so bad. It was still going on when I went to bed at 2:30 a.m. Silva hadn't known Senator Kennedy was at the party until the next morning, when the accident car was hoisted from Poca Pond. His wife recognized the automobile immediately. She'd noticed the car go by the house several times that afternoon, driven by a middle-aged man with gray hair, she said. I saw the same man driving the car after 9 o'clock in the evening. He was heading towards the ferry. Flynn was surprised at the modesty of a premises hired for a Kennedy party. The living room kitchen was paneled in knotty pine. There was a dining table and 4 chairs, a floor lamp, and a studio couch wrapped in flowered cretonne. A 9x12 Sears and Roebuck carpet filled the living room's entire floor space. A waist-high counter divided the living room from a galley kitchen. Flynn found 4 packages of frozen crab meat, butter, milk, and 3 bags of ice cubes in the refrigerator. A bathroom separated 2 bedrooms, identically furnished with a varnished chest of drawers, a bottle lamp, and mirror. A blanket was rolled at the foot of each twin bed, each so neatly made Flynn wondered that they'd been slept in. Silva pointed out a backyard building. That's Mrs. Lawrence's studio. She paints there. The studio was locked. Flynn and Killen took a place in the line of automobiles waiting to board the On Time. The ferry was packed with visitors returning from Edgartown's newest tourist attraction. The traffic broke all previous records by more than 100 cars, owner-operator Jared Grant revealed. Grant had taken Senator Kennedy and a man he didn't know to Chappaquiddick around 6:30 p.m., Friday night. He had operated the ferry until 12:45 a.m., when he made his last run to Chappaquiddick. Grant puttered around the boat for another half hour. The reason I stayed was it was too hot to sleep. He had observed a lot of people in the area on the Edgartown side. Several youths were fishing off the dock. Boats were running back and forth in the harbor, he said. It was a beautiful night, very calm. The water was like glass. Grant closed down at 1:20 a.m. He didn't recall taking Senator Kennedy to Edgartown. I was dead certain I didn't bring him back until I got to reading the papers. He might have been on, I don't know. The ferry could be summoned at any hour. We come out for any legitimate reason, Grant said. It doesn't have to be a case of an accident or injury. Ferryman Dick Hewitt said, "If someone wanted ferry service after midnight, they would call Jared's or my house. The numbers are posted on a sign on either side of the ferry." There was a public telephone inside the ferry house at Chappaquiddick. A bell was attached to the side of the building. What people do is drive up to the ramp and leave their lights on, and we come across to get them. If you walk down, you ring the bell. Hewitt was highly critical of Senator Kennedy's report of the accident. He said, "You tell me, is Kennedy finished? Or are they going to paper this over with $20 bills?" By the time he debarked from the On Time, Flynn had put together a scenario for the accident. "I figure we got a drunk driver, Ted Kennedy. He's with this girl. And he has it in his mind to go down to the beach and make love to her. He's probably driving too fast, and he misses the curve and goes into Cemetery Road. He's backing out when he sees this guy in uniform coming toward him. That's panic for the average driver who's been drinking. But here's a United States senator about to get tagged for driving under. He doesn't want to get caught with a girl in his car on a deserted road late at night and driving drunk on top of it. In his mind, the most important thing is to get away from the situation. He doesn't wait around. He takes off down the road. He's probably looking in the rearview mirror to see if this cop is following him. He doesn't even see the fucking bridge, and bingo, he goes off. He gets out of the car, she doesn't. The poor son of a bitch doesn't know what to do. He's thinking, I want to get back to my house, to my friends, which is a common reaction. There are houses on Dyke Road he could have gone to report the accident, but he doesn't want to. Because it's the same situation he was trying to get away from at the corner, which turned out to be minor compared to what happened later. Now there's been an accident, and the girl's probably dead. All the more reason not to go banging on somebody's door in the middle of the night and admit what he was doing. He doesn't want to reveal himself. The crowning irony was, Teddy Kennedy was running from nothing, Flynn said. Huck Look couldn't have made an arrest even if he wanted to. He didn't have the authority. You're only a special police officer at the place you're assigned. Kennedy doesn't know that. All he knows is some guy in uniform is coming after him. And the funny part about it was, Huck is only trying to help him find his direction. Chapter 16. Killen didn't mention Flynn's theory when he reported to Edmund Denise what his informal investigation of the accident had revealed. Killen had talked to the district attorney that morning. Denise was questioning Dr. Mills' diagnosis of death by accidental drowning and wondered about an autopsy. Mills was satisfied with the cause of death, Killen said. The issue was moot anyway. The accident victim had left Martha's Vineyard at 9:30 a.m. But Killen hadn't bothered to check with undertaker Eugene Fry. As it was, the body of Mary Jo Kopechne was in a garage section of the Edgartown Airport. Dunn Gifford was waiting to serve as escort. So far, neither a plane nor permission to take off had materialized. Gifford was concerned the delay was due to a hold for autopsy placed on the body by authorities. Fry assured him there was no such order. Poor visibility made it impossible for a single-engine aircraft to make the flight. Fry had given permission for a twin-engine plane to be used instead. Then, an oil failure necessitated finding another aircraft. The plane did not leave Edgartown until 12:30 p.m. on Sunday afternoon. Gifford had never met the Kopechnes. I just wanted to help them in any way, he said. David Burke was announced in charge of funeral arrangements, but when Gifford arrived in Wilkes Barre, he learned Mr. Kopechne had already spoken to Mr. Keelty and made the arrangements. The senator paid for flying the body to Pennsylvania, but the Kopechnes refused repeated offers by the Kennedy family to pay for the funeral. The money they had put aside for their daughter's wedding, Joseph Kopechne said, we are using instead for her funeral. The Kopechnes had moved when Mary Jo was a year old, but decided to have her buried in Plymouth, because this is where her roots are. The medical examiner's report that Mary Jo had drowned had been accepted without qualification. Her death was an unavoidable accident. Senator Kennedy telephoned on Sunday afternoon, Kopechne revealed. He said he wished he had died in the accident instead of Mary Jo. Senator Kennedy also called Dr. Robert Watt to say he was feeling better and did not require him to make a house call. The senator would remain under his care for a period of time, Watt said. We are playing it by ear. Kennedy was reported despondent, in seclusion, refusing to be drawn out about the accident during meetings with his staff and advisors with regard to the complaint Arena was seeking in the case. In Gargan's view, there was no prosecutable charge against Ted Kennedy for leaving the scene. All the law said you had to do is make known you've had an accident causing more than $200 damage or that has injured somebody. It doesn't say report it to the police, the fire department, or anyone else. All it says is you are to report it. The senator had not left the scene without reporting the accident. because he made it known to me and Paul Markham that he was the driver of an automobile that, as far as he knew, had seriously injured a girl who was in the vehicle with him, and brought us to the scene to make a serious rescue effort, Gargan said. In addition to having reported the accident to two persons, we happened to be two lawyers, so that was frosting on the cake. That was so much better to report to, because we were officers of the court, and that forfeited the state's case. It would be very difficult to prove leaving the scene under those circumstances, Gargan said. Whether he should have taken quicker action to rescue the girl, or all of those other factors, that's a different question. Gargan had known cases of death resulting from automobile accidents which had been prosecuted for manslaughter. That was quite common. There was nothing exceptional about it. That didn't mean a lot of times the person wasn't acquitted, but you had to go through a trial. Gargan had defended hundreds of automobile cases, some involving serious injury and sometimes death. Once, a school teacher killed a child in the street. No drinking involved or anything like that. A perfectly nice man with five children who was being torn apart because he is on trial for manslaughter. Despite his wide experience with accident cases, Gargan didn't think he was the best lawyer to advise Ted Kennedy, because I was involved and therefore not objective. Gargan suggested the senator get a lawyer knowledgeable about such matters. As respected for his legal ability as Edward Hanafy was, he was no lawyer for this kind of case either. The best available lawyer, in Gargan's opinion, was Dave Kelly, of his former law firm, Badger, Parrish, Sullivan and Frederick, whose principal business was defending insurance companies. Kelly was a tough trial lawyer. He could care less who Ted Kennedy was, Gargan said. He'd keep his eye on the facts, irrespective of the press or the people on Ted's staff giving him totally unwarranted advice and only confusing things. Gargan considered this an automobile accident case that should be handled like one, he said later. Unfortunately, a good friend of mine got killed, which made it much more serious an accident. But the only thing that made it different from an ordinary accident was that Ted Kennedy was involved. Granted, he was a United States senator and also a Kennedy. But the facts of the case, the incident itself was just an automobile accident. I never lost sight of that fact, as I think some others did. Though Gargan gave what he thought was the best advice, Ted didn't have to take that advice, and neither did anybody else, he said. As a matter of fact, they didn't take my advice in several respects. He wasn't being allowed very close to the situation, or to some conferees at the compound. Gargan was a pariah, as responsible for the incident as Senator Kennedy. I don't know about blaming me for the accident and not reporting it, Gargan said, but some staff members, would-be friends and others, did try to indicate blame for me having the party, the location of it, and other arrangements that led up to this disaster. That I had put the senator in the middle of this situation, which I resented a great deal. They were saying, if it weren't for that damn Joey Gargan who wanted to have his party for the boiler room, this never would have happened. And they knew that wasn't so. We'd been going to Edgartown regattas and having parties for years and years. This was nothing new. Except that the girls from Bobby's campaign were being entertained by me and the senator. It wasn't just my party, sort of to placate Joey. It was something everybody wanted to do. The senator had fully participated in these plans. If Gargan could eventually blame himself for anything, it was when he returned to the landing with Paul Markham the second time and didn't swim across. He said, "If I had dove into the water and followed the senator to Edgartown, things would have turned out differently. I didn't do that. The judgment I made at that time was a mistake." Among the advisors at the compound, Gargan found a measure of sympathy from Burke Marshall. He said, "You've got no reason to hang your head, Joe." Gargan wasn't sure if Marshall had been told about his rescue efforts at Dyke Bridge. It was apparent, however, Marshall had not been apprised of the scenario the senator had proposed, the one underlying the long delay in reporting the accident. Groping for a rationale to explain the lapse of 10 hours, Marshall said, "That night, in that situation, I think Ted Kennedy might very well have functioned so that the people with him, particularly if they weren't strong-minded people, would think he knew exactly what he was doing. That was a dead giveaway. The senator wasn't leveling with his own advisors, and was sticking with his police report, attributing his failure to notify authorities to shock. Had Marshall been told the truth, Gargan suspected he wouldn't have wanted anything to do with the case. There was no question Dave Burke knew about the senator's reluctance to report the accident, up to the time he'd spoken with him from the Chappaquiddick Ferry House. It was Burke who at that late hour persuaded Ted Kennedy to go to the Edgartown police. Burke encountered Gargan coming off the private beach at the compound where he'd gone swimming. Burke suggested Gargan photograph the deep scratches on his chest and upper arms as evidence of the rescue effort he'd made at Dyke Bridge. Gargan dismissed the idea out of hand. As far as I was concerned, I was just a witness to a certain aspect of the accident, he said. My injuries had no bearing on the case at all. Edward Hanafy set Gargan straight on exactly what bearing he would have on the matter. Because he was representing Ted Kennedy, Hanafy couldn't talk to him about the case, suggesting Gargan discuss the accident with a lawyer. Hanafy told Paul Markham the same thing. You people are going to be highly criticized, he said. I think you ought to protect yourselves. Since they had risked their lives to get Mary Jo out of the car, Gargan wasn't sure what it was they could be criticized for, he said. Hanafy recognized that as lawyers, Paul and I might feel we could represent our own interests. He thought we should get some objective outside advice. Gargan failed to recognize the difficult position he and Markham were in, until Hanafy told him Ted Kennedy considered he'd have a lawyer-client relationship with them. Whatever advice they had given him after the accident, the senator didn't want disclosed to anyone. Kennedy was invoking privileged communication to prevent Gargan and Markham from revealing what had happened on Chappaquiddick after the accident. Gargan supposed a quasi-case could be made that he had advised the senator as a lawyer to report the accident. There was no question Gargan had done that. In the car, at the landing, and at the Shiretown Inn the next morning. According to the Code of Ethics drawn up by the American Bar Association, and adopted by most state boards, attorneys could not counsel or assist clients to take an action the lawyer knows to be illegal or fraudulent. And assist is exactly what Gargan would have done had he gone along with Kennedy's plan. By failing to report the accident, the senator had made of Gargan and Markham unwitting accomplices in his effort to conceal it from police for more than 9 hours, involving them in a net of intrigue so as to avoid his own responsibility for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Now, he was invoking lawyer-client privilege to prevent them from telling anybody what they knew. Paul Markham was offended by the suggestion he'd acted as the senator's attorney. He had hardly participated in the discussion in the car and at the ferry landing at all, merely seconding Gargan's reiterated insistence the accident be reported immediately. Markham confided to his law partner, Edward Harrington. Ted wasn't looking for legal advice from anybody at the time. The senator had ordered them not to do anything, not even tell the people back at the cottage the accident had happened. What had really blown Markham's mind the next morning was that Ted Kennedy hadn't reported the accident, and was still insisting on not reporting it. Markham's advice had not been sought at the police station. The senator had participated in lengthy telephone conferences with his staff in Washington while composing his statement. Gargan recognized the convention of advisors at the compound was single-minded. They were only concerned about protecting the senator. They didn't care about protecting Paul Markham, Joe Gargan, the girls or other fellows at the party, or anybody else. They let us fend for ourselves. Gargan had made up his mind years before, if he ever got into any trouble of a personal nature, I would go to Joe Donahue. I'd known him since I was a child. He was a great friend of my father's. I had a high degree of respect for his ability. There weren't many kinds of cases he hadn't tried. At that time, not feeling that I would need a lawyer at all, I thought I would chat with him about the accident. The famous Jiggs Donahue of Lowell was a legend in the Massachusetts bar, a widely admired criminal lawyer. Donahue agreed to meet Gargan the next day, Monday. Despite Hanafy's warning, Gargan feared no liability for the part he played in the accident. In fact, I was rather proud of myself for what I had done under those particular circumstances. Neither the press nor anyone else had gotten the information as yet that Paul and I had made a serious rescue effort, had done the diving in the water and all those things. So I was feeling that whatever happened, I would be exonerated of any blame. The scale of the disaster was brought home to Gargan when he made his way out of the compound, past a swarm of reporters at the police rope-off on Scudder Avenue. Gargan recognized Sylvia Wright of Life magazine and Joe Mobat of the Associated Press, reporters who had been on trips Gargan had advanced that spring for Senator Kennedy. But other members of the press paid him no attention. I'd passed them by and they never asked a question. I was never approached for a statement, Gargan said, simply because I don't think they knew who I was. But reporters were concentrating their expectations on the release of a statement of further clarification about the accident from Senator Kennedy. The compound was filling up with advisers, but nothing was coming out. A telegram sent by Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield to Ted Kennedy, delivered to the compound on Sunday afternoon, was immediately leaked to reporters. Deeply shocked and disturbed over tragedy which occurred over weekend. What happened to you could have happened to any one of us. You have our full confidence, and if in any way I can be of assistance, please let me know. Mansfield didn't think the accident had damaged Kennedy's political career at all. After all, senators are human beings too. It's just one of those things that could happen. I'm sure the police chief is aware of all the facts, and I don't think it will affect the senator in any way. Kennedy's efforts to dive in search of Mary Jo Kopechne supported his report he was dazed after the accident, Mansfield said. He's been going around with a back brace for several years since he was almost killed in an airplane accident. It would have been directly against his doctor's orders to dive into the water. This could have contributed to his exhaustion and shock. It's quite understandable that Senator Kennedy could have been stunned and might not have known what he was doing for several hours after the accident. Mansfield hadn't talked to Senator Kennedy, only his staff. Obviously, Mansfield had been prevailed upon to issue a sweeping and unqualified public endorsement of the senator's version of the accident. Others in Washington were not so indulgent. Concern was being privately expressed the accident could damage Kennedy's career if he didn't disclose more information than his report to police. Aides in the senator's office declined to answer questions about the senator's movements after the accident. Dick Drain had no details about the incident, he said. Drain refused to provide a guest list of at least 20 people who had attended the party. Ethel Kennedy released a statement from Hyannisport. Mary Jo was a sweet, wonderful girl. She worked for Bobby for years, and she was in the boiler room, the phone room used for delegate counts during the campaign. Only the great ones worked there, and she was just terrific, she said. She often came out to the house, and she was the one who stayed up all night typing Bobby's speech on Vietnam. She was a wonderful person. The statement provoked ripples of derision from information-starved reporters at the barricade. Ethel had not acknowledged an accident had occurred, mentioned that Mary Jo had been killed, or that her brother-in-law was driving the accident car. The statement was patronizing as hell, in one reporter's opinion. Typing was the operative word to signify Mary Jo had been devoted in service to the Kennedys. All that was required to account for her death, apparently, was a posthumous pat on the head. The situation didn't lend itself to smug tributes to former employees. In the opinion of this female reporter, no amount of public relations was going to get around the fact that Mary Jo Kopechne had died in Ted Kennedy's car, and he had taken 10 hours to tell police about it. The Kennedys had had their share of troubles, but tragedy was not their exclusive province. And this tragedy more properly belonged to the Kopechne family. Ted Kennedy had survived the accident. Mary Jo Kopechne hadn't. More significantly, such patronizing effusions reflected an evasiveness to confront the issue of the accident head-on, and the confusion of purpose inside the compound. The Kennedy apparatus, so skilled at manipulating the media, was losing its sure and practiced grip on the press which had played so large a part in their political ascendancy. With a legion of friendly reporters only too happy to tell Ted's side of the incident, if provided the information to do so, the silence within the compound was all the more baffling. A list of questions about the accident sent by the New York Times through an intermediary inside the compound received no response. Security police were used to relay word to reporters that Senator Kennedy had nothing further to say about the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Speculation about the accident multiplied as a result of the blackout, prompting reportorial mutterings of discontent. First newspaper accounts of the accident had been nearly uniformly sympathetic. The Boston Globe published 10 stories about the accident, pushing the Apollo moonshot to the bottom of page one. Our coverage was justified, managing editor Ian Menzies said. The Kennedys are one of the most important families in history. The Globe described the senator as the only surviving brother in a family pursued by tragedy. The same mournful tone echoed in a New York Times reference to the doom-haunted Kennedy family. Curiously, the Times failed to acknowledge the major contributions made to its coverage by James Reston. Returning a rental car to a garage in Falmouth, Reston was asked by owner Alvin Nickerson, "What's going on over in Edgartown?" Reston replied, "I'd love to tell the story, but they won't let me." Other Timesmen had since arrived to cover the accident. The Times published the lousy picture of Ted Kennedy taken by Harvey Ewing. Unsatisfactory as it was to Ewing, the photograph captured the senator in mid-stride, looking fit and trim. Graphic evidence that, at approximately 9:45 a.m. Saturday morning, he had been neither in a state of exhaustion nor shock, nor appeared to have suffered any significant injury as a result of the accident. As a humid, overcast Sunday afternoon rolled around, reporters at the barricade had nothing to do but monitor the occasional automobile allowed past the roadblock. When it started raining, most reporters abandoned their posts. A hard core were huddled under umbrellas when a boy ran across Scudder Avenue calling out, "They've just landed on the moon!" But the accident at Chappaquiddick was casting a shadow over an event that was to have been one of great personal pride for Senator Kennedy, the Globe reported. Instead, he was being forced by tragedy and controversy to remain cloistered in Hyannisport, reported by aides under a doctor's care. It was John F. Kennedy who had launched the program to put an American on the moon before the decade ended. In anticipation of the triumph that would attach to the Kennedy legacy when the Apollo mission fulfilled that dream, television networks had prepared advanced interviews with Ted Kennedy. Only ABC intended to show the program as scheduled. "It's strictly on the subject of the moon landing," a spokesman said. "It has nothing to do with the incident at Martha's Vineyard." Senator Kennedy spent the better part of Sunday with members of his staff, preparing a formal statement to the press about the accident. But at the last minute, a decision was made to withhold comment. By the time Don Gifford got back to Cape Cod from Pennsylvania and saw Ted Kennedy, he was in a state of mind I'd never quite seen him in before. Down, but determined. He wanted to make a statement, go to court, and get the whole goddamn thing settled right then. Chapter 17. Jimmy Smith spent Sunday watching the moon landing on television, reading newspaper accounts of the Kennedy accident, and reflecting on his invitation to the now famous cookout at Chappaquiddick. On Wednesday, July 16th, Joe Gargan had come to Falmouth. Smith had taken him around to meet local builders and developers, with a view to Gargan's new position as vice president of the Merchants Bank in Hyannis. During lunch at the Coonamesset Inn, Gargan mentioned he was sailing the Victoria to Edgartown the following day. A cookout was planned for the girls who had worked Robert Kennedy's boiler room, he said. "If you're in Edgartown for the regatta, drop in and see us." The invitation was given in the spirit of having something to eat after the races, with the same old crowd that had something in common, Smith recalled. A lot of people who held Bobby in high regard suffered a personal crisis when he was killed. There was an awful sense of loss. So these gatherings were a chance for people who'd had a similar experience to get together, like a reunion of guys that had been in battle. Smith declined the invitation. Saturday, July 19th was his wedding anniversary. He was taking his wife out to dinner. Besides, Smith knew only one of the boiler room girls. Her name was Mary Jo Kopechne. Now, reading about the Kennedy secretary killed in the accident, the remembrance of the girl added to his sense of pain. As a campaign coordinator for Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania in 1968, Smith had maintained daily telephone contact with Robert Kennedy for president headquarters in Washington, where a half dozen young women compiled delegate intelligence in black loose-leaf notebooks of the states. Mary Jo Kopechne had been in charge of Pennsylvania. Smith had talked to her almost every day. To refer to her as a secretary, however, was to misinterpret the work of the boiler room. The importance of that work was, in fact, the subject of a memorandum Smith had received from Paul Kirk, aide to Kenneth O'Donnell in the campaign. Memorandum from Paul Kirk. REF. Delegate reports to Ken O'Donnell from Illinois, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. As we well know, the above states have been described in the press as the crucial battleground for the August convention. Although fully aware that there is varying leadership control of the delegations in each of the above states, we are nevertheless attempting to compile information on each of the delegates or potential delegates to be elected or chosen. To help us initially in this effort, we would like to get, as soon as possible, the following kinds of information on each of the delegates on the attached list, with whom you may be familiar. Phone numbers, age, occupation, marital status, at-large, district delegate, what district or alternate, full vote or fraction vote, public official, what office, candidate, if so, for what office and against whom, whether a delegate in 1964 or 1960, present voting tendency, feelings about RFK, what or who will most influence his vote, what advice or suggestions you can submit to the candidate or to us to assist you in influencing his vote, what progress has been made by you or your people in your respective states on each delegate, any other comments. This list of names and any pertinent information can be updated to us by daily memo or at your convenience, but we do ask that we hear from you or your representatives by Friday of each week, care of Kennedy for President Headquarters, 6th floor, 2000 L Street, Washington, D.C. Some of the principals in the Washington headquarters may have further helpful information on the delegates in your state, which we will communicate to you as soon as possible, so that you may follow it up. Kindly let us know where you can be reached by phone if you change your location. All of the above information should be submitted to us or to the girls in the boiler room who are maintaining the delegate files. They in turn will keep us informed. No mere file clerk of intelligence on delegates, Mary Jo had directed Smith's attention to potential volunteers to assist him on his fieldwork. In Smith's opinion, Mary Jo and the others brought to their work a precision and shrewd judgment that marked them as politically savvy, not mere secretaries. Mary Jo recommended a Vietnam veteran and freelance writer who knows two delegates who could be picked off, and the president of a small company in Erie, Pennsylvania, who had worked for JFK in 1960. She said, "I checked, and this is true. He was a delegate at large and Democratic committee chairman. Worth looking into." In addition, the boiler room was the conduit for policy statements composed by media control managers of the campaign to be planted in newspapers. On April 26, 1968, Smith had been advised, "As major a figure as possible in each state should say whatever best suits him regarding Kennedy versus Humphrey, with the following suggestions. 1. Humphrey had time after Johnson's withdrawal to enter primaries in California and South Dakota like Kennedy and McCarthy, but waited until filing deadlines passed to avoid submitting his candidacy and his administration's record in Vietnam to the people. 2. Now a gang-up to stop Kennedy is underway, combining Southern governors from Maddox to Connally with George Meany, whose organizers are totally blanketing the country high-pressuring political and labor leaders to support Humphrey, and enlisting both the special interest lobbies from Wall Street to oil and the major Republican newspapers. But the people are with Kennedy, and they are fed up with this kind of power politics and propaganda. 3. By supporting the candidate of the status quo, which Nixon is attacking, by picking him